Hello and welcome to
Cannabis Conundrum.
Do you ever feel like you could be doing more with your life?
Speaking that knowledge.
Do you feel like you're getting in your own way? Do you feel like you're capable of more? Much, much more? Do you feel like you've had enough energy and time you could make it happen? Do you suspect that maybe your diet, lifestyle, and how you think about things could create the foundation for maximum creativity, bountiful connection, and effortless flow? Well, if so, tonight's guest is here to help you clear the way. The art of living deeply connected starts with abundant energy and mental clarity. Let's help you bridge the gap between your current state and your infinite potential. Tonight, yes, it starts with cannabis. I have a new friend that I would like you all to meet. He's an epigenomic life coach.
Hi, my name's David Krantz.
Tonight, we're gonna clear things up you didn't even know was fuzzy. Hello, and welcome to
Cannabis Conundrum Podcast.
If you would like to know more about yourself, cannabis, and nutrigenomics, stay tuned.
Smoke weed every day.
Heck yes.
Hello and welcome to the Cannabis Conundrum. I am your host, Desert Fox, and I have to say I am super excited today because we have a guest that is going to bring a new light to all of you when it comes to cannabis, but honestly, I think we're going to get into some other things as well. I'm super pleased to introduce to you all David Krantz. Are you with me?
Yes, I am. Hey, thank you, Desert Fox. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to talk to you about genetics and cannabis and specifically how and why different people respond differently to weed. There's some really interesting research that's been done in the past, 10 or so years, and I'm really personally fascinated. I've spent quite a few hours delving into it and kind of synthesizing it into something that is not arcane science jargon and that hopefully most people can understand. So I appreciate you having me on the show and letting me talk about this.
I have to say, I heard you on Superhumans. I'm a fan of Boomers, and it just blew my mind. The more that I heard you talk, I'm looking at website, and I actually stopped the interview to go and listen to the webinar, and just there's so many things that as soon as I hear them, I'm boom, that makes sense to me now. That's something that I didn't realize it didn't make sense until I heard you say it. So
right, yeah.
Epigenetics in a nutshell, we are all pre-programmed for, we need different things.
Yeah, so what we've learned in the past, 15, 20 years since we mapped the human genome is, what are these differences in our DNA that cause people to respond to different foods and substances differently. Now, it's pretty easy to imagine, you probably have a different hair color than your wife and a different hair color than me, and it's pretty easy to understand differences in the very basic code that makes up your body that is going to create different proteins for one person versus another, and that's going to kind of express as a different trait in different people. And the same thing happens in terms of all of these tiny little biochemical reactions that happen in the body, including the endocannabinoid system and the way that our body senses THC, breaks it down, and responds and relates to a lot of the different substances, beyond THC and cannabis, like terpenes and CBD and all these other things. There can be kind of individual variations. And so my work is I'm a coach, and I help people kind of understand their individual predispositions and, what type of food and supplements might help their specific body. But I got really interested in cannabis and looking at it through the nutrigenomic lens. Nutrigenomics is kind of the name for this field. Mm-hmm. And I got really interested in looking at through the lens of nutrigenomics because, I'm a long-term cannabis user and I've made it my kind of life's goal here to spread the word about nutrigenomics because it's something that's really helped me personally health-wise and found it very valuable in my clinics. But I realized there's all this similar information about cannabis. It's actually, there's less about it because of the research climate. It's hard to research and get funding for.
It's super hard, and it's still a Schedule I drug federally.
Right, yeah. So the amount of information that's out there about this stuff is less than something like, say, caffeine, which is a very, very widely studied substance. Then you really understand a lot of different facets of the way our bodies interact with caffeine. And so, there's a smaller amount of research on cannabis in that way, but it's there, and I think it's time, you know, it's 2018, it's time that people are educated and understand this, because when you get into it, we'll see it really kind of shed some light on, like you said, experiences that you've had where, you know, maybe a friend doesn't like weed, and you're sitting there going, you know, this is the best thing ever.
Oh my goodness, I've had so many.
Yeah, and but, you know, or you have a friend that gets too high and gets in a weird headspace, and you just, you know, smoke the same amount of it as him, and, you know, you have a different reaction. There's, you know, all kinds of things like that. And so I've been really involved in kind of studying what those differences are and how we can use them to better predict people's responses in the future. And also, you know, as we'll talk about, maybe use as a template for developing custom strains for specific people or specific illnesses in the future.
That is amazing. Different strains?
Potentially. So that's where this is going. We're not there yet, but this is the beginning of, you know, really matching specific strains to people's individual needs.
Well, we live in a state that's medical marijuana only, but when you go to the store, it's like a store, and you can go to the counter and say, hey, you know what, I need to do this or that or the other, and I don't want to get the munchies, or, you know, okay, you need this, hey, you need that, and they will fine-tune you. I'm kind of impressed sometimes how much they fine-tune you, but that's not really where I want to go. I want to save that for a little bit. You touched on the endocannabinoid system, and I think that a lot of my listeners have heard that term, but are probably a little fuzzy on what it is, and even non-smokers alike, everybody has one, right? Is that that's what we're talking about?
Yeah, everyone has one. I want to back up just a sec, though, and talk a little bit more, just give a little bit more background
okay.
on genetics and what are called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms. I know it's a mouthful, but it should only take a sec to explain here. So you know that your DNA is made of these different amino acids that are strung together like a computer code, right? And they're arranged in this double helix. Like, that's the basic. That's what, you know, everyone kind of learns in biology class, right? It's just this repeating code, and everyone's is a little bit different. Well, since we've mapped the human genome, we've identified all of these different locations where it's most likely that someone is going to have a one-letter difference in their code from a person to another. So, you know, you might have in, say, the 156th position on your 23rd chromosome an A, and I have a T in terms of the letter that we use to represent those things. So think about it as just like a one-letter switch in your DNA. We've been able to match up those letter code differences with different traits or different disease risks. So, you know, there's all these studies where they'll take a group A that has heart disease, group B doesn't have heart disease, and they'll kind of scan through their genomes and really see if there's any genetic differences they can identify. You know, they've done that with cannabis studies, like, just to give you an example, and we'll go more into this. There's a liver enzyme called CYP2C9, and certain people that have one variant in this particular place in their genetic code break down THC much less completely than people that have the other variant. And you can kind of predict someone's THC metabolism by understanding what letter exists in that particular place in their DNA.
Can I cut you off just for a second? You're saying that your metabolism, the way you process food, doesn't necessarily mean the way you process THC.
Right, yeah, there's many different pathways, and each one of those pathways is kind of responsible for a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we can look at this with saturated fat or carbohydrates or vitamin C, and we can apply the same lens to THC and cannabis, which, you know, for a stoner is pretty exciting, I think.
I think people are already listening, connecting dots.
Your next question, in terms of the endocannabinoid system, we have these receptors that designed to accept THC in our brain. And they now know there's kind of two forms of these receptors. There's the cannabinoid 1 and cannabinoid 2 receptors. And the cannabinoid 1 receptors are found more in the brain, and the cannabinoid 2 receptors are found more in the body. And they respond to chemicals that we produce naturally on our own that are also cannabinoids. And so when you actually look at it from an evolutionary sense, it's because we have a common ancestor, right? We evolved at some point from a similar organism that also had an endocannabinoid system. You know, plants, before plants and humans had even emerged, right? The cannabinoid chemical structure is actually fundamental to biology in a lot of ways. And because we have, we are primed to respond to THC, you know, we've experienced cannabis the way we do, but we also produce our own cannabinoids internally. And the main one that we produce is called anandamide. And the name of it is actually named after the Sanskrit word for bliss, which is ananda. The researchers that discovered it noticed that it mimics the effects of bliss in rats. So it got that name.
That's awesome.
Right? Isn't that funny? So yeah, we produce anandamide on our own naturally in our body. It reacts with these CB1 receptors. We also have another main cannabinoid called 2AE. It's a acronym for a much longer name. And that responds to the CB2 receptors that are found more distributed throughout the body and not in the brain. Those chemicals seem to really serve a balancing role in the body. And they seem to interact with a lot of other systems in the body, like neurotransmitters and our nervous system and immune system. And they kind of seem to
hold everything together.
Yeah. They serve like a regulatory role. They glue everything together. They serve as a communication piece between different systems in the body. And the more we look, the more we find these receptors. They now know, and by the way, these were only, you know, really discovered, I believe, in the late 80s. So we've only known that we have these receptors in our bodies for, you know, 30 years, just to give you an idea of how little we know about the human body and where we are in medical history, you know, what we'll know in the future. But these chemicals seem to serve a regulatory role, and they're heavily involved in like the stress response, in mental functioning, in eating behavior, feeding behavior. Obviously, if you've ever smoked weed, you know you get the munchies. Your endocannabinoid system, just without any input from weed, is really heavily involved in feeding behavior. Like, they've done studies with rats where, you know, they modify those receptors, and the way that they eat and timing cycle and everything like that gets way thrown off. So, like, all of these very low-level processes, right, like eating and the impulse to eat is a really, really basic thing, right? You know, that's being driven to some degree by the endocannabinoid system.
It's okay. It's a commercial break. No one can hear you. We'll be right back.
Hello, welcome, good morning, and I'm happy you're here at a podcast I like to call We Live on a Planet. And we cut that out so quickly, it sounded like it was going to be all professional for a minute. Oh well, thank you for joining me, I'm glad you're here. We got a lot of stuff I want to talk about today. We have The Secret, The Daily Teachings, Positive Quote, some music, I like taking phone calls from you guys, and a random fact, This Day History as well. So I'm glad you're here. Grab yourself a cup of coffee. Thank you if you're listening through iTunes, Google Play, Pocket Cast, Overcast, Anycast, you name it, cast. I appreciate it. I can't thank you enough. We're going to just talk some stuff and things. Maybe we'll learn a couple things as well. We live on a planet. So come on over and check me out.
Here's where I kind of differ in the way that I interpret some of this research, too, is, you know, a lot of these studies I'm looking at are done from an addiction standpoint. They're done from a harmful behavior kind of quote-unquote standpoint, because that's what people can get clean for. So the language of it is based around, you know, this is not being a beneficial thing for anyone. But when you really look at it and look at and kind of understand that there's certain things that are going to be protective, it changes the dynamic of, you know, cannabis in general. Like, it's like we're just not at a point anymore where you can make like statements about it. It's like the subtlety is there, and it's really an individual response. You might tell that to some people and they would basically not believe you, right? Like, oh, you can't possibly have performed better at your, you know, being stoned. Like, but, you know, it's so individual. And the more I understand about the genetic side of it, the more I realize how little we do know about, you know, what those little individual idiosyncrasies might be and what we might unearth in the future here. So
there was a guy who my next episode is actually going to come out tomorrow, but it's athletes and marijuana. There was actually a guy, I was asked by a sports guy to answer a series of questions about some somebody who took cannabis oil who was recruited to Auburn, and they found out he took cannabis oil. He also had epilepsy. That's what he took the cannabis oil for, and his roster spot was revoked, and he wanted me to comment on that. And I got into this other tangent on all these other things. I found a story. There was a guy, he's a free agent running back in the NFL, who just told the league, they call it a TUE, he submitted a TUE to the league beginning of May that said, I openly smoke cannabis and here's why. And they told him that they denied it only because he didn't have enough substantiated proof that he has chronic pain, which they kind of think that it's about to change. And that made me look at other sports as well. And virtually every professional sport has above a 60% margin. And it's, you know, not substantiated, but we're talking about Michael Phelps is one of the biggest athletes on the planet. He's won more gold medals than anybody in 1 year. And he's a very big open pot advocate. Yes, I smoke weed every day.
Yeah.
So I feel like your work is to get rid of the stigmatism, but at the same time go, you know what? It's not for everybody. And it's beautiful. I feel like some people, for me in particular, it makes me more focused. I can get more accomplished. I get scatterbrained without it. And people think that I'm intoxicated if I don't have it.
I mean, that's the beauty of it. And that's the beauty of the, you know, the bio-individuality of us all. Let me give you an example that I think might even just further kind of hammer that point home. There's a genetic variation that everyone has some variant of it called APOE. And they found that in about 25% of people, there's an elevated risk for Alzheimer's with this gene variant. 25% of people have it, but it only seems to be present if they don't exercise and eat a diet that's high in saturated fat throughout their life. Like, that becomes a major risk factor. So saturated fat as a substance, like, we know there's certain people that genetically are predisposed to get Alzheimer's if they eat saturated fat. Now, there's nothing, there's a small link between cannabis and schizophrenia, and that also seems to be genetically mediated in a much, much smaller way. It's like 25% versus, like, you know, less than 1% of the population. And if we're going to outlaw cannabis and tell people that it's dangerous, like, we should be outlawing saturated fat. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's absolutely absurd that we can't have a nuanced discussion about this in the same way that we can about, you know, sugar or fat or any other thing that, you know, doesn't have the emotional kind of attachment thing that we have in this culture to it. And I love what you're saying about athletes too, because, you know, it's really unknown what the effects are in high performers and in people that have atypical, awesome genes and biology to begin with. You know, probably aware that the U.S. government holds some patents on parts of cannabis, right? Yeah, so one of them is for THCA, which is like the unsmoked version of THC. It's before it's decarboxylated. And there's just some studies that came out this last year talking about how it's like showing that it's a mitochondrial enhancer. It activates this enzyme called PPAR gamma. That's like a huge research topic right now. Everyone's trying to figure out how to activate it. And the U.S. government's had a patent on THCA for like 10 years or something. It's pretty long since they've known that it's essentially a performance enhancing substance. And when you're talking about the guy using the cannabis oil for seizures, that's the main component in like that raw kind of extruded cannabis oil like that. And so there's so many different components of the plant. You know, there's so many different possibilities for what it could be used for. And like, just to give you an example, there are no genetic studies that I'm aware of right now on even CBD. And you know how many people of CBD has helped. I mean, it's a wonder drug for some people, but then, you know, realistically, some people try it and it doesn't help them out that much. So the question is, can we identify something in people's genetics that might predict that and then, you know, guide people towards the right treatment without, you know, having to wait a bunch of, you know, waste time, you know, testing things out. We might be able just to get people more directly connected with the medication that's going to help them.
That's a huge problem in some states. I was just handed a story yesterday. I haven't even really had a lot of time to look at it, but there was a guy and a father in Georgia who was arrested, I think 2 weeks ago, because He had a little hemp farm. He didn't have a cannabis farm. He didn't have THC plants. He had males. And he had specific recipes that he learned from YouTube that he was making for his 7-year-old son. And they found out that he was doing that, and he was arrested. And now he's, Georgia's one of those states. It's the stigma. So many people think this, and that's why your work is so important, because we can say, you know what, it's not for you, maybe it's not for him, but some people, some situations, a lot of situations nowadays, am I right? I've heard you talk about PTSD. I would like to bring that up. It seems like that might be a cause and a cure.
Yeah, PTSD is really interesting, and MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, has been doing some really good pioneering research on PTSD and cannabis. And going back to the endocannabinoid system, there's some pretty interesting correlations between kind of abnormal cannabinoid levels in people with PTSD. And like, for example, people that have diagnosed with PTSD are known to have lower levels of anandamide, that cannabinoid we were talking about earlier.
Like damaged somehow.
Yeah, or like that system becomes depressed in those systems that's not able to produce its own cannabinoids. And for people in that situation, it seems like smoking weed can really help alleviate those symptoms. You hear veterans talking about how it's the only relief they've had from crippling conditions, since they came back from war. It's really upsetting to me that they can't get medicine. It's not recognized and they can't get this medicine. But it's also really exciting to me to have, this research coming out that is going to allow us to be more precise and personalized with understanding, maybe which veterans are going to respond well to cannabis. That's the kind of stuff that the work that I'm doing is going to help predict. So it's interesting. And the other thing that kind of ties into that is there's some really interesting research on the cannabinoid 1 receptor again, that's related to actually like adverse childhood events, the traumatic things that happen in childhood to people. And it appears that certain variants of that gene are actually protective of depression and PTSD later in life from those events. So you see the cannabinoid system being really heavily involved in stress resiliency kind of all the way through from childhood to adults with PTSD and kind of everywhere in between.
So ebbs and flows. Ebbs and flows, like maybe does a person's genetic code change? Maybe, for instance, menopause would cause somebody to need it more?
Yeah, well, that would be epigenetic changes. So that would be changes in the genetic expression. And something like menopause absolutely changes epigenetic expression. And certainly, a traumatic event does, too. It changes the stress response, changes the way that people relate, and changes hormone levels, that kind of thing. Hormones are very, very epigenetic in nature in the way that they work in the body. And so, you can see changes in time, and that's kind of the next generation of research that's definitely coming. We're looking at epigenetic effects everywhere, and there's already a few studies looking at epigenetic effects of cannabis over time, but it's at the very beginning, and there's not quite enough there to really make it applicable to people yet. The SNPs and the genetic variants you can actually use to predict things. With the epigenetic stuff, there's just not quite enough there to really understand it yet, but it's coming, and it's going to be pretty exciting.
It is going to be exciting. We're going to go a little bit advanced. And back to myself in particular, my wife is a heavy indica fan. I have found that she wakes me up sometimes on the couch to tell me to go to bed. When we get the really good indica, when it's more of a hybrid or a sativa, there's certain consumption methods, certain strains that help certain people.
Yeah, there definitely are. And as far as the individual makeup of specific strains and the different terpenes and cannabinoids that they consist of, we're not there yet where we can genetically predict what you can respond to, but it's very clear that those different kind of chemical soups, of the plant that they produce from strain to strain, and why it tastes different, why it feels a little bit different, those, once we understand more what those things are doing in the body, we really are going to be able to figure out how certain strains affect people differently and why. And there's pretty good research on specific terpenes. Like, we know some are better for reducing anxiety, and some are better for focus or mood, feeling uplifted, or like you said, falling asleep with an indica. You know, those studies and sort of being able to personalize, like, that's pretty much what the whole field's trying to work on right now. It's kind of in that dash to really hone in on it. And it's, I think one of the things that I love about the cannabis industry and community is there's a lot of good crowdsourced sharing of information. You know, I mean, like Leafly, like the site, like, there's so many good strain reviews. Like, you can really see what people's response is. And, you know, when you look through a site like that and see how people gravitate towards different strains and how people, like, really prefer one over the other, like, I'm a Jack Herer guy for life. Like, anything Jack Herer cross, like, I'll take it. And, you know, it does something for me. And it's like, I'm just such a geek about this stuff. I want to know, you know, what the details are and what are these doing differently in the brain. And, you know, from a medical cannabis perspective, of course, it's going to be just so interesting to really understand, well, what terpenes we really want to use for this particular medical condition.
I want you to say something real quick. You've said a few times, you've mentioned the word terpenes, and I think a lot of my listeners have no idea what you're talking about. I do.
Okay.
But I think that you would have a way better answer than I would. What are terpenes, and why are they important?
Okay, so terpenes are chemicals that the cannabis plant produces naturally, actually somewhat as a defense mechanism from other, you know, bugs and insects and that kind of thing. And they're the same molecules that you find in any kind of aromatic plant, like lavender, rosemary, oranges, lemons, things that have a very particular scent. A lot of those times, those scents come from a chemical class called terpenes. And, you know, terpenes essentially are the reason why that, like, grape ape tastes like grape, and lemon skunk has a little bit of citrus to it. It's those flavors. They're responsible. The terpenes in cannabis are responsible for those flavors. And cannabis is just this incredible, powerhouse of a terpene factory. Like, you know, most plants out there, like, say, for example, lemons, you know, lemons produce a terpene called limonene. And there's maybe one or two other ones, but cannabis is capable of producing, like, almost the whole range of terpenes that are found in nature, which is why you get all these awesome strains that kind of, you know, all remind you of, like, Fruity Pebbles or whatever, you know, or Gorilla Glue or, you know, whatever. It, like, these terpenes show up elsewhere, and cannabis is a great mimicker in a way of, like, these other plants and things. So these flavorful compounds also have really pretty potent effects on the brain and the body. And it appears that, like, okay, for example, like, have you ever, you know, you've taken, like, if you're ever taking, like, just almost pure THC, it feels very different than smoking flower, right?
Yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of distillates. I learned recently that he was telling me about percentages, and he said if you had 100% THC, it would be a solid. It would not be a liquid. Mm-hmm. He said, so the less that your distillate pen moves when you flip it upside down, that's your best indicator. If it moves instantly down, it's not. Mm-hmm. Maybe 80%. I'm like, really? That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. But just in general, you know, like, distillates that are very, very high THC, you know, feel different than flower, especially because flower has kind of like a balance of these terpenes. And usually extracts have some terpenes in there. And now there's a lot of places that are adding terpenes in to kind of give more of a flavor. Because you can do that, but it's the more we look at it, it seems like these terpenes kind of have a synergistic effect with THC. Like, when
do they have a differing effect? If you eat them?
You know what? I don't actually know too much about the edible effects of terpenes, but I do know, I mean, there is definitely a difference between the effects of THC when you eat it and when you smoke it. And there's a pretty cool genetic variant that kind of can help predict that, like I mentioned earlier. And I have a whole, and like you mentioned, I have a whole webinar. It's an hour long webinar on my site,
mm-hmm.
and some articles that if anyone that's listening is interested, they can look up more information about this, and I have some information if you have 23andMe or any kind of genetic testing done, you can go look this stuff up yourself, start to kind of do some detective work on your own endocannabinoid genetic variants.
That's a great point to ask this question. Have you done your own genetic code? Have you fine-tuned what works best for you?
Yeah, I have, and that's what I focus on with clients is kind of going through their genetic codes with them as well. And I'm the intermediate metabolizer variant of THC, so I fall kind of right in the middle between someone who, this is the CYP2C9 gene. And it affects especially when you eat cannabis, because when you smoke cannabis, like, it enters your bloodstream really quickly. You don't have to, like, process it the same way you would if, you know, through your intestines, and it just takes longer when you eat cannabis, right? There's more metabolic activity that happens when you eat something versus when you smoke something.
When you get to the point where you're, oh, okay, I'm feeling it, you realize if I've eaten too much or not enough.
Yeah. It turns out there's actually, like, a genetic reason why some people get totally slammed by edibles, and some people it doesn't hit them as much, but, like, there's roughly about 15% of the population that has this slow THC metabolizer variant where, they, instead of breaking THC all the way down into, like, the inactive form, they actually kind of build up this sort of secondary breakdown product of THC, where you kind of, like, they kind of half break it down, and then they actually get higher because that breakdown product is also psychoactive. You see people, you know, if people are like, oh, I can't do edibles, it's usually because that they're just hypersensitive to it because it's more psychoactive for them. And there's a really cool gene that you can look up to help predict that for yourself.
Is there separate receptors for edibles per se, rather than smokables?
In a way, yeah, because edibles tend to interact more with the CB2 receptors, which are going to be found more, like, in your small intestines and other parts of your body rather than in your brain. Yeah, because when you smoke it, you know, it's more easily able to cross the blood-brain barrier and can interact with the CB1 receptors in the brain.
That's me, your neighborhood sports dealer,
Jay Hayes.
Yeah, 25-8 to be exact, because 24-7 is not enough. You are tuned in to Cannabis Conundrum right now. But when you get done, come check me out at Mr. 25-8, because 24-7 is not enough. Sports and more radio coming through your speakers on Anchor.fm, iTunes, Breaker, CastBox, Pocket Cast, Radio Public.
Mr. 25-8, because 24-7 ain't enough.
Yeah!
Now, back to Cannabis Conundrum.
Oh, you fucking up the rotation. Puff, puff, give. Puff, puff, give. Fucking up the rotation.
It's fascinating to me because I have a hugely fast metabolism. I was told as a kid that my brother could look at a steak and gain weight, and I could eat the whole cow and not gain an ounce. And then when it comes to cannabis and THC, I don't know. As much as I'm a veteran, people smoke me under the table all the time. Uh-huh. And when I heard your work, when I see what you're doing, I'm like, oh my goodness, see? I can't help that shit.
Yeah.
This is who I am, man.
So what's really interesting, you've given me two clues now about something that I would guess about a specific variant that you have in the cannabinoid 1 receptor gene, because there's this one variant that is both associated with not really developing much of a tolerance to cannabis, and it also, when you told me earlier about eating and only being hungry when you eat or when you consume cannabis, both of those things, like, apply to this particular variant. So it would be very interesting to look and see if that was true for you, and then that did match up. Very interesting.
That leads me to another question, oddly enough. Is there somewhere that somebody can contact you and sign up, maybe donate their time or their energy to your research?
So to be clear, I'm not actively doing the hard science of this research. I'm more reading papers and collecting this data. And honestly, a lot of what I do is writing. I do a lot of writing around kind of collecting this information and speaking. So as far as donating their time, anyone who's interested in this, I'd love to talk to you about it, especially if you have another angle on this. If someone else out there is involved in research that's related to this, let's talk. I'd love to talk, and I'm always interested in meeting other people that are doing similar things or doing this. And in general, anyone can get in contact with me via my website. And if anyone's interested in looking into their genes, I offer free 30-minute consultations for anyone who's interested in learning more, whether it's cannabis-related or nutrition-related or better health condition or just wanting to perform better or feel better. That's kind of what I do for people. So thanks for asking that question, though. Anyone who's interested in the genetics of cannabis and the response to cannabis, I'm super interested in talking to you. So yeah, just put it out there.
Absolutely. I mean, we all have to come together to make this thing happen. There's a lot of tests, a lot of studies that need to happen that haven't been able to happen yet.
Mm-hmm.
And anything we can do to facilitate any of it, because I looking back at the sports stories that I did, I saw across the board that they wanted more testing. There is a new breed of people that aren't professional athletes they call themselves cannabis athletes, because specifically working out is more fun when you're stoned. Working out doesn't hurt as much when you smoke a joint before you go in. And there's specific yoga clubs here in Arizona that are cannabis friendly. They encourage you to use cannabis before you come here.
Yeah, totally.
So I think that's how we end that stigma. That's how we need each other. And what your work is beautiful. Everything that you're doing is beautiful.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And we're really entering an era where citizen science has a value and weight. And you don't have to be in a lab at a university to contribute to this kind of stuff. I encourage people to look out for, potential studies in their areas that they could get involved in, just as a research participant, potentially. And, just kind of keep your eyes open. And, It's like you got to come together as a community and kind of all share knowledge here. So, you're doing a great job with that with this show, and especially on just the culture and the political side of things. And I'm trying to do what I can on the science education side of things, and hopefully we make a difference to where people that are deciding what the law is going to be about, hearing the balanced, fair, and nuanced real talk about cannabis as more than just something that has been illegal for 80 years. It goes way deeper than that.
It goes way deeper than that, because before it was into prohibition, it used to be a law that everybody had to grow it. If you had land and you could grow something, you were required to grow some form of cannabis for the government.
Yeah.
And then it went from that.
Paper. Mm-hmm.
There's so many different levels and so many different things to say.
Yeah.
Well, I have one question.
Okay.
Is there a certain gene that makes people susceptible, if you will, to need marijuana in their diet?
In their diet, in terms of edibles and eating?
In their consumption routine.
Oh, yeah, consumption routine. Just in general, there are certain ones that definitely influence. There's like three or four that are really, really strongly correlated. There's a really cool gene I was talking about earlier, the FAAH gene that controls the anandamide levels. That gene, in conjunction, when you combine that, look at that gene, look at the cannabinoid receptor 1 gene at the same time, there's a correlation between those genes and people's dopamine centers in their brains lighting up on an MRI scan when they're exposed to marijuana smoke. So the actual reward response system in the brain either gets activated more or less for people, like when they smell weed, they just like that. I mean, you know what it's like when you're walking down the street and you smell weed. It's like you can't mistake it for anything. It's weed. It's like does something biologically to your brain. Like they captured this on brain scans and correlated it with these different genetic variants. So there's those two. There's a couple other ones. There's a gene called DBH. There's a few other ones. It'd be kind of tedious to go through them all, but it definitely seems like there's a strong genetic component to people wanting weed and it, you know, wanting to engage with it. And, you know, like, they've known for a while that, cannabis consumption kind of runs in families. But they've also known that...
Really?
Yep, for sure. If your parents smoke weed, you're somewhat more likely to smoke weed. But they also know from twin studies where they'll look at identical twins where that's not 100% heritable. So there's, you know, there's some kind of genetic differences between, you know, one twin and another that is going to account for some kind of difference in their weed smoking preference. And it seems
one person gets the strong endocannabinoid system, the other one gets the lack of.
Uh-huh, exactly. And so you...
That makes sense.
That's kind of the working theory right now. I think it's the formal name is like the endocannabinoid balance theory. I'm way oversimplifying it. And to be honest, I only understand a portion of it because it's very complex and there's a whole lot of different factors to it. But that's kind of the gist of it that we understand right now is, if someone has lower levels of their own cannabinoids, they're going to tend to seek out cannabis or other sources. And, that's actually been something that I've really personally interested in for both myself and my coaching clients is, well, how do you modulate or influence the endocannabinoid system without necessarily using cannabis to do it? Because what's really cool is that there's actually a bunch of other plants that produce cannabinoids and other plants that also can influence. Yeah, so it can also influence the cannabinoid system.
Plants like what?
Echinacea. Are you familiar with echinacea?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's commonly known as an immune system booster, but it actually produces some of that effect by acting on the cannabinoid 2 receptors. It's pretty cool. It's pretty unique property of it. And then there's some other things like, for example, maca, which is an herb that's
it's an ink and powder, yeah. We use maca in our smoothies. We make smoothies here at the house. Maca, and I always have raw cacao, mm-hmm. cacao nibs. Yeah, I'm very attuned to maca.
Yep. Cacao has theobromine in it that it interacts with the cannabinoid system in some way. And then maca is an FAAH inhibitor. So maca actually naturally will raise your levels of cannabinoids because it lowers the level of the chemical that breaks down anandamide,
are you telling me it is pretty cool? I have to ask, are you telling me that if I cut the maca out of the shake, I might be able to hang the rest of the night? Is that having an effect on I can't hang with the indica for too long?
oh, you're saying like on your tolerance?
It amazes me that I could have a tolerance. I am an everyday smoker. That's what I do.
I don't know. I would be interested to know if that did make an effect on your tolerance. I'd be fascinated to know, actually.
I'm curious to try it now. I mean, something clicked in my head when you said that. I'm like, really? I'm sure goji berries is somewhere on the list too. I'm consciously consuming all these things that have cannabinoids in them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was oblivious to it. I was oblivious.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, that we do all the time is we're always consuming terpenes, you know, in other things. And especially if you use essential oils, oils have tons and tons of terpenes in them. And you can kind of actually play around with shaping your cannabis high a little bit by smelling different essential oils because you can get some of those similar terpenes and combinations of terpenes just from smelling those oils and kind of adding them into your high in a way, which is kind of fun to play around with.
I had somebody tell me something, and this is a little off topic, but I don't think really. She said that she would get ounces, and she said, I don't smoke enough, so what I do is cure them. I put them in a big jar with lemon peels and orange peels. And it she said somehow something that does over time, it gets better for her. And that just clicked in my head too when you said that.
That's pretty interesting. You know, I remember reading, I mean, man, I was probably like, you know, 14, 15, like just started smoking weed, and like, remember reading like that you should put an orange or lemon peel in your bag of weed if it gets too dry. I remember reading that to like moisten it back up. But that's really interesting. And, you know, I could imagine that some of the aromatic, you know, terpenes from the orange peel or lemons could, you know, kind of land on the bud and add more of that for her. It's pretty cool.
She said over time, and absolutely tastes more citrusy. Everything tastes more citrusy. And I really thought, you know, that has nothing to do with how powerful it is or how it hits you. But she said it got stronger over time, and you just confirmed that for me. I think, yeah, it probably did now, huh?
Yeah, and you know, I think the terpenes that are associated with that type of orangey, citrusy flavor are generally more of the sedative kind of ones, like strains, like I'm thinking of like Orange Crush, it's more like heavy, orangey, indica, like super citrusy kind of buds like that.
They are usually, yeah, citrus or lemon or, yeah, you're right. I've never seen a sativa that was citrusy.
yeah, at least not too super, yeah, super like sweet and sticky, stickly sweet kind of citrus stuff. So it's indica, for sure.
Is there any, I was told once that everything originally started out sativa. That there didn't used to be a natural indica, and that was bred into the plant.
You know, I'm not an expert on like, cannabis plant genetics and like that. My understanding is that the indicas were more native to like the Middle Eastern area. And that there were two different land races, and this is also my understanding, and I could be wrong too. But I always thought that indica was a natural strain, and sativa was. They just come from different climates. Because I know like sativa is like more like African in origin, and I like Afghan Kush. I always thought Afghan Kush was just like that would be more like the strains that are grown from there. But I could also totally off base on that too.
I haven't done my research on that in particular, but it was actually somebody in the dispensary once again who said that, yeah, everything indica was bred into the plant. It was the cross breeding of sativas that made an indica.
I can see that.
Regardless, that's an interesting thing I should look up. But I totally appreciate your time, brother. This is going to be a great episode. I cannot wait. We have had David Krantz on the show, and we have learned so much tonight, and I cannot thank him enough. If you have any questions, the show notes are going to have links to his website, links to his Gmail. If you want to get involved, this is a good place to start. Thank you, brother. I cannot thank you enough. If we have more that we have to cover, please come back.
I imagine I will be back in the future. I'd love to do it again. Super fun talking to you, and yeah, thanks for having me on Cannabis Conundrum.
Nailed it.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.